This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky.
I'm Jennifer Doyle.
And I'm Pablo Morales.
And we are joined now by Dave Zirin, the preeminent progressive sports journalist in America. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. He is also the author of The People's History of Sports.
To be called the most progressive sports journalist is like, I guess, being called the most pacifistic Republican.
Dave Zirin, welcome to The People's Game.
Thank you so much.
Dave, I just want to say I love your blog, Edge of Sports. I very much recommend it to our listeners if you're not already familiar with it.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's been a lot of fun to do, and one of the things I've learned from it is that there are a lot of people out there like us, like you, me, Pablo, and Alan. I mean, people who really do love sports but don't want to feel like we're checking our politics at the door and then shut our mouths when sports reflects all the things that we demonstrate against when we're not watching sports.
Here's a really arcane reference. You know, Yoko Ono and John Lennon used to do these things called bag-ins back in the 60s, bagism. I don't know if you remember that. It's like in Give Peace a Chance, what the heck are they talking about?
And they used to just a gleam in my father's bloodshot eye in the 60s.
And Yoko Ono used to say, and this is really obtuse, but it's from Yoko Ono back in the 60s, that if she could be in one of these bags with Adolf Hitler, he would never have perpetrated the crimes against humanity perpetrated. This sort of, you know, intimate form of communication. My line on it is all the people who aren't soccer fans, if they just hung out with me and my friends and watched one soccer game, by the end of the game, they'd be soccer fans. My take also is if you do that 1, 2, 3 times, by the end of it, if you're like a moderate or a conservative, I'll convert you into being a radical leftist.
I'm actually a performance studies scholar, so I'm actually picturing, if I remember right, the bagism is it was a large bag
right.
That people would step inside. They would step inside the bag together. So it'd be a little bit like living and wrestling inside one of a big soccer ball.
Indeed, indeed. But again,
okay, we digress.
And the point I'm trying to make is to concur with Dave, which is that the text of sports can be a entry into a welcoming way for people to receive a radical political critique, find it friendly, and find it on point.
Absolutely and positively, and that's been the thing I've heard, which is honestly where I just feel the best about doing this kind of work is when people tell me things like, hey, my family's really right-wing, but I gave them your book or showed them an article, and because it was sports, all the walls didn't come up right away. Like, oh, you're trying to convert me to some leftist project or whatever. And they were actually able to then actually have a talk about things like racism, sexism, or homophobia, and just be able to do it through the language of sports, which I think for a lot of people is just less threatening.
Yeah, I just want to say I really appreciated what you wrote, how you responded to the U.S. victory against Algeria, which was both to celebrate the victory but to ask this very basic question, and I think it's one that haunts a lot of us. You know, why must an insanely miraculous athletic victory also be a reinforcer of cultural supremacy? And I feel like we're actually kind of on the other end of that that question, sort of in a slightly different place in response to the U.S.'s performance today against a very valiant Ghanaian team.
It's one of those things where it's like the politics are part of it, Jennifer, whether we want it to be or not. I mean, we can say we don't believe in gravity. It won't help us when we fall out of an airplane. And so we can say, oh, the U.S. beat Algeria, and all that is the U.S. beating Algeria, and it's the World Cup, and you root for the U.S. because you're an American. But then you turn on sports radio like I did, and you hear the announcer say, well, the Algerians are just terrorists, and what the hell is Algeria anyway? It's a setting for an Abbott and Costello movie. And it's just like, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
I think it's definitely true in World Cup soccer. You have different kinds of nationalisms. I mean, just think about in 2002 when France played Senegal. It's interpreted in profoundly different ways, whether you're France, which used to be the colonizer of Senegal, or whether you're Senegal and you're actually celebrating that you defeated France. It may not have been defeating them on the battlefield. It may not be defeating them in the United Nations, but you're defeating them nonetheless through the representation of sports. And there is a political undercurrent there that's very real. And today with Ghana, I mean, I just filed my article about it, and I just kept thinking about the fact that the African teams, this is, everyone's saying it, it's the marketing hook, this is Africa's World Cup. The African teams underperformed dramatically in the opening rounds. To have Ghana, the last Africa team left, advance over the United States and to see people celebrate across the continents, I think one would have to be absolutely politically tone deaf
to
not see that there's something else going on with those celebrations.
And Ghana, and the first independent head of state of Ghana, Nkrumah, was a great Pan-Africanist, too.
Absolutely.
And the Black Star throws back to that era.
It is the avatar of African independence, the country of Ghana. And their very name, the Black Stars, comes from the sculpture, the monument in Ghana of the large black star, meant to represent the fact that they were the first true independent nation in Africa, the first decolonized independent nation. And, I mean, part of it also is, I could just tell you this because, you know, I was in South Africa for some time before the start of the World Cup, and these aren't secrets. I mean, everybody knew that there would be more Americans watching World Cup games in the stadiums than non-South African Africans, for all the talk of it being an African World Cup. Everybody knew that more McDonald's would be sold than African food at the World Cup. Everyone knew that FIFA had the trademark lock, stock, and barrel on all the goods that would be sold. And everyone knew as well that no matter what the outcome of the World Cup, the West would win and Africa would lose economically. So to have them have some victory on the pitch, it's not meaningless. It's not bread and circuses. It's not irrelevant. I mean, there's something real there that I think people need to reckon with.
Yeah, I find it really moving too. Watching, I mean, I thought it was a very tense game, and they brought everything. The Ghanaian players, I mean, they brought everything to the field, both defensively and offensively. They threw everything but the kitchen sink at the U.S. I mean, it was a great win, and it was well deserved. I mean, the goals they scored were well deserved goals. I mean, just
no question about it. Yeah. No question about it. And I really do feel like if the U.S. had ended that game against Algeria in a tie and had been sent home from the World Cup without having lost a single game, that would have been something very bitter to swallow, because in several of those games there were questionable calls, whether you're a U.S. fan or not, whether you want to see the U.S. lose or root for the U.S., it would have been a very ugly end to a team that had a lot of hopes with them. But today, I mean, they were outplayed. The Ghanaian team in the first half dominated, and in the second half, their goalkeeper, Richard Kingston, put on an absolute clinic, and I think reminded a lot of us of what Tim Howard, the keeper for the U.S., really hasn't done in this World Cup. Tim Howard has made every save he was supposed to make, but as far as making that spectacular save, we didn't really see that from Tim Howard, and we saw it from Richard Kingston.
That's fair. You know, I just think it's really sad as a U.S. fan that it had to be the U.S. that had to play Ghana in this round. I thought about it. It's like if this had only been Germany that Ghana had beat, or England, you know, that how much sweeter that would have been. Because I really wanted African nations to do well in this tournament. So I was really twisted in terms of my loyalties right up until kickoff, when it was all red, white, and blue. But now I definitely am looking forward to supporting Ghana and hoping they get all the way. This would be wonderful for the sport and the continent.
It would. The only other team I'm rooting for is the team I picked at the part of the tournament, and that's just part of the weird culture of sports writing. You know, if I'm right about that, some random pick I made a couple weeks ago, then I get to say I'm smart.
And that was Argentina, I understand.
That is true.
Uh-huh. Right. But Argentina and Diego Maradona has cloaked himself in the rhetoric of the radical left. So there's more to it than just your prediction, perhaps.
That is true. And I'm one of those people who believes, you know, maybe quaintly, maybe naively, that when sports is played beautifully, it does rise to the level of art, and it has the capacity to really, really inspire people, and, you know, maybe even inspire people politically. And I put people like Steve Nash in that category. Like, I actually feel inspired when I see Steve Nash play basketball. And you know who else I feel inspired by is Lionel Messi. And I love watching him play. There's something kismet-ish about the idea of Diego Maradona, who Pele accused of only coaching the team because he ran out of money. But Maradona, the crazy Maradona, being the coach of the World Cup winning team.
And the Maradona who speaks in Buenos Aires and calls out President Bush and says he's just not welcome on the continent of South America, that he's an imperialist and a colonialist in 2005.
That is true. That is true.
Dave, soccer in the United States and the World Cup, the right wing's hatred of it. One of the things we've spoken about a lot on this show is the issue of soccer and the resistance to soccer within the domestic United States by the sports establishments, by the sports media establishment. What do you make of the last month, the hype around the U.S. team, the real huge amount of money invested from Disney, ABC, ESPN to the World Cup tournament? To my mind, and I'm a soccer partisan, a football partisan, I see, you know, football. I do think that the right has something to fear. I think this is an entry point into internationalism, to solidarity with the joy that people have in the most popular sport in the world, as opposed to the sort of nothing against the American sports that are popular, but the insulated culture of American sports in the United States.
Well, let's take it at that last point there, because it's also hilarious to hear the right-wing blabosphere say, we like American sports like football and baseball. And it's like, the roots of baseball are actually in England, and the roots of football are in rugby. Yeah. So what are you really talking about, this idea of this authentic
Actually,
American
the roots
sport?
Of football is football. I mean, otherwise, why would they have that name? The rugby That's is also too. A form of football. They just decide mm-hmm. to pick it up and carry the ball. I think it's also interesting that it's the one thing that seems to be capable of uniting a Beck and a Obermann is this fear of, you know, international sports. You know, I think that's an amazing thing. That shows how powerful it is, I guess.
Yeah, and except I do think that there's a difference there, because I think Obermann sounds like an absolute ignoramus when he talks about football, soccer, but Beck, I mean, it really is linked to this broader political fear of the other, kind of hyper-nativism. And if you go back and go to Media Matters, which is so brilliant about these things, and you listen to Beck's rants against soccer, it's always linked to this idea of Obama. And I wish Obama was the Obama that he so fears, quite frankly. I don't recognize the Obama that he describes. But when he attacks Obama, he's not really attacking the Barack Obama who's disappointed a great many of us. He's attacking this sort of, in his mind, avatar of global equality.
Yeah, it's like basically some kind of mishmash of gay, women, Latino,
socialism.
Soccer-playing, socialist art people. Right, that's sort of all balled up into this sort of trope, right? Of
what you just described sounds like a fun weekend.
Yeah, totally.
and to Glenn Beck, it's something to make money off of by stoking everybody's reptile brain for their darkest fears of some sort of other. Mm-hmm. That's what he does for a living, and he threw soccer in with that. And one of the things I wrote about this a couple weeks ago was that I thought it would be a lot of fun to see the U.S. do a run. To see the far right caught in a vice between wanting to get on the bandwagon of the attendant patriotism and what they've already laid out, which is that soccer is some sort of socialist, Marxist, gay, whatever.
that was a great piece, by the way. I sent that to a lot of my friends who don't quite get the link, and they really enjoyed it.
And what's so funny, too, is the right-wing blabosphere also picked up that article, and their comment on it was, that I was saying Americans are racist who hate soccer. And it's so funny to me because they say that because they actually look at Glenn Beck as an archetype of what is America. And that's part of this discussion, too. What is America? It's like when Sarah Palin has the nerve to say we are all Arizonans.
Oh, God.
You know, what is the we that she is talking about? Yeah. Who are the Americans who Glenn Beck represents? It's a shrinking demographic in this country.
Yeah, and that's really where it comes from, right? Is that impending sense of one's own irrelevance. I mean, that's this kind of this sense of fear, right, that he's on the losing side, and I think he knows it. You know, and you see this, I think, in a lot of different kinds of structures of powers at the moment. I've been thinking a lot about what's been going on with the French Football Federation, for example, and the kind of decaying structures of European football and how they look in relationship to the young people who are fans of the sport, the young people who are playing the sport. It's a very different sort of generational and political spaces of contemporary European culture. And that to me looks like, say, the structure of the University of California, which is my employer, a disconnect between our students, faculty, and administration, also reflecting larger kinds of problems in the power structures in California. And soccer, you know, it actually brings up some of these sorts of larger structural problems around the racialization of class, for example. Major generational and demographic differences are actually being played out around this sport in really powerful and amazing ways, which you've been writing about for quite a while.
The hilarious thing, or it's not hilarious at all, but the obvious thing would be if Beck actually gave soccer a chance. Well, it's not in his financial interest to do so because it's too useful as this avatar of the other.
Yeah.
But if he actually did give it a chance and enjoyed it, you might be able to connect with some of the patriotism like Uncle Sam's Army that's out there that I actually do think has a pretty serious right-wing tinge
yep.
to it.
Yep.
And I think that's what ABC and ESPN have really made an effort to do.
Yeah.
Actually, you know,
make it politically neutral, but also in terms of linking it with the armed forces and showing a lot of the USA
yeah.
of troops in Afghanistan when I watch the goals of trying to politicize it in a way as well.
You know, the funny thing, too, is because, you know, we're down here in Southern California, and I sometimes refer to it on the show as Greater Mexico. You know, there's no doubt that as popular as Team USA became, I think, in the past weeks, obviously, they're games were very dramatic. The team was very resilient. They won a lot of people over. Mexico, the passion for Mexico in Southern California is super intense. I found myself drawn to the USA team like I never did before. They cut to the troops in Afghanistan, and that chills my enthusiasm for them so much, you know.
Mm-hmm. But they have to do that.
Well, they do it. I don't think they have to do it, but they do it, you know. I would never expect them not to, let's put it
right,
that way.
Yeah. Right, right. I interviewed a lot of the Sam's Army guys down in Mexico City just before the qualifier down there, and I think there are two distinct camps within those groups.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely the hardcore nationalists, but I find them to be the least soccer sophisticated of the bunch. The ones that are truly, you know the game, played the game perhaps, I'll even say that, a lot of them were Hispanic. A lot of them didn't get along with some of the more, you know, radical members within that their own organization. But they felt that the United States deserved a cheering section like every other soccer nation in the world. And that's where their motivation came from, is that there should be a group of fans that the players can run to and know that they've got their undying loyal support. And in that regard, I tip my hat off to them.
Well, even before the Bush era, when clearly the United States had sort of re-entrenched as this symbol of super agro-imperialist domination, as opposed to the sort of
global cop.
Yeah, global cop, right. I had a very ambiguous relationship to Team USA because I had this experience as a child in the late 70s, early 80s of moving to Italy. And all I cared about in Italy was being as good as everyone else. I came back to the States, and I was great at soccer in the States. So all of a sudden I start thinking, you know, I went to a school that played soccer. Well, what World Cup team would I have played for if I had been only a little bit better, because I was pretty good, was Team USA. My heart was not with them. I thought, like a lot of people do around the world, didn't really want USA becoming like an interloper in the sport. They have anything else. Keep them out of this. They wreck everything with their glitzy faux culture, corporate culture crap. Keep them out of the beautiful game. And, you know, there was a lot of sentiment. But I think the USA team, and just in its quality and the quality of its players, and the fact that I think generally the team doesn't carry itself with a lot of, like, you know, imperialist super cop bravado. I think they actually have gained entry into the international football community in a decent way.
Yeah, a lot of casual fans don't realize the behind the eight ball that most good soccer players from the United States start in. I remember this one story about Todd Ramos when he played in Spain. When he did something well, he was an Uruguayan-born player. When he did something bad, he's one of those crappy U.S. soccer players, you know, and that's sort of where it comes, you know, that's what they have to get overcome.
Jennifer?
No, I was just thinking that when you root for women's football, you're not really burdened with all of these sorts of problems.
Except when Bill Clinton showed up at the 99 finals against China, that had an undercurrent. There was something there, although with Clinton, I might have been misinterpreting what.
Yeah, I don't even want to think about that.
Yeah, let's
so.
Not go there.
What was your take then on Team USA and the sort of political undercurrents of its ride in the 2010 World Cup?
Oh gosh, I mean, I thought they played an inspiring brand of soccer. I think we've definitely crossed the Rubicon in this country in terms of both popularity of the sport, I think the World Cup helped with dramatically, and in terms of the quality of players we have, because now over half of our players play in Europe. Our goalkeeper, Tim Howard, he's the best goalkeeper in the entire English Premier League, I would argue. So it's like it's a brand new world, and I think the ceiling and expectations moving forward for every World Cup should be quarterfinals or semifinals, and that's going to undoubtedly help with the growth of the sport. That being said, I think politically, I'm one of those people who I think is going to be somebody who likes rooting for the underdog. And for a lot of people, they've rooted for the United States over the years because they were the underdog, and those days are done. So yeah. I don't think the U.S. will be seen as an underdog again, and so that means politically, I think we might want to start looking at some other countries if we want to see a Rocky Balboa moment.
Yeah.
And what do you think about soccer in this now new level of popularity in the United States related to an entry point into ideals of social justice and internationalism?
Well, I think whenever we think about these things, it always has to be conscious. This is the work of you, Jennifer, you, Alan, you, Pablo. It's the work of me, because I really don't think when it comes to sport, unless you have an athlete like an Ali or a Steve Nash who actually speaks out, I don't think it happens organically. I think it's about people being inspired by play and what play represents, and then us engaging with what it represents
yeah.
and trying to articulate it in a way that actually connects with fans.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I think that also I think players need our support in our engagement.
Oh, absolutely.
Because yeah, it's the rare player who's willing to actually put their career on the line ahead of everything to take up really important political issues. Many of them are young and, not confident in taking strong political stances against the organizations that are supporting their play. And I think of our critical engagement with the sport as a way of supporting the sport and supporting the people who play it.
And that beautifully. Hear,
and,
hear.
And Dave, you have time ever and want to look into something amazing, look at the fans' efforts of the great British clubs Liverpool and Manchester United to take them out of the hands of the global financial capitalists who own them.
My book comes out in late July. It's called Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, and I have a chapter on Liverpool.
I'll bet you
it's
do.
It's brilliant stuff. And again, you're so right, though, about keeping that stuff conscious, because this is the place where we remind people of this and that these sports can be taken back by the people from the clutches of global capital.
Hey, if you want to talk about the book, particularly the Liverpool chapter, when it comes out, I'd love to come on.
Oh, we would love to have you on to talk about that. Jeez. Thank you for giving your time to us. We're really so pleased to have had you on the show today.
Yeah, keep up the good work.
My privilege.
Thank you so much, Dave.
You guys, good work, too.